Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode, sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and mini-series. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Today, Steph asks Nate some questions about Let It Roll in our farewell episode. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and that might be the last time I say this for a while. We're going to take a hiatus from the show. I'm pretty burned out and have a lot of obligations at my day job. And so Steph's going to ask me some questions to kind of wrap up the series, at least for now. And that's what this episode is going to be.
So, Nate, this has been a massive project for you. It spanned more than 6 years. We have been doing this for a long time now. What was the original goal of Let It Roll, and how did it change over the course of this long run?
Well, the original goal of Let It Roll was kind of to give Edward a boost on his history of rock and roll, and to give me a chance to do podcasting that wasn't about mixed martial arts or cage fighting. And I got pretty comfortable with that, and I enjoyed it. And so we kept doing it even after Ed passed.
How was it for you when Ed passed? Because you guys podcasted closely together for 2 years.
I mean, it was sad, but it was also one of those situations where I was glad that Ed was past his worries. You know, he was somebody who'd kind of found himself in a hard spot late in life, financially, and didn't have a lot of, you know, didn't have a spouse or kids or anybody to help him out. And, you know, times are hard, and it had been very hard. I didn't know Ed well, but I'd been acquainted with him since like 2003, and I knew he had been struggling that whole time. And so, you know, it was just kind of hard to watch somebody that I admired so much for his writing and knowledge of musical history kind of being tossed aside by the system. I mean, you know, he was his own worst enemies, and constantly did things that self-sabotaged himself, like quitting Fresh Air on NPR because they wouldn't give him a whole episode about his book, but they were giving him a plug on every episode. So, you know, that kind of stuff, you would just kind of like smack your head and be like, Ed, why did you do that? You know, so it was mixed feelings. I was glad that his worries were over. He'd had, you know, lots of drama. He'd had a flood in his house. It destroyed a lot of his things. Ed was a character, and maybe a warning to people who pursue their passions over, you know, more traditional responsibilities. I think Ed probably could have used a steady day job at some point in his life. And, you know, I mean, from what I can tell, he was a big part of the beginning of South by Southwest, and it's very typical that he ended up with nothing out of that and other people got rich. It's just kind of Edward's lot in life. But I really, you know, loved his writing. I was a big fan of his piece of the history of rock and roll and the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll that came out in the 80s. And he wrote a third of that, the part that covered, you know, basically the 1900 to 1960 portion of it. And I still think for that era of musical history, he's got few rivals. He really had a handle on 50s R&B and rock and country and folk that few people had, and an ability to weave stories together. You know, he could go through a big pile of old Billboard and Cashbox magazines and weave it into a pretty seamless narrative. I think he was a gifted writer, and definitely enjoyed learning from him and talking to him about music. That was really fun. And then, you know, from there, the series kind of evolved into, it was fun, so I wanted to keep doing it. And I also wanted to learn more about the history of music. I mean, I went into this thinking, oh, I know all about this stuff, and then very quickly realized, wow, I didn't know anything about this stuff. And Ed's methodology, I thought, was really good, that his focus on, you know, what were the audiences paying attention to, what was the social context, what was the economic context, who were the non-musical players in this, the managers, the publishers, the record label owners, who, you know, frequently had as big or bigger part to play in this than the musicians. I mean, somebody like Sam Phillips, you listen to his collected works, the way Peter Guralnick selected them, and you can hear, you know, even when he's working with people like Howlin' Wolf and B.B. King and Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis, you can hear Sam Phillips imposing himself on those people. And you know, even B.B. King comes out and does a rock and roll song when he's working with Sam Phillips. And it there was definitely a sound that Phillips was after and a feel Phillips was after, and he was able to create it over and over again. And there were just some things that I felt like I disagreed with Ed about, but I didn't know enough to argue my case. And then that, you know, spurred me to study it more. And so at this point, I think it's really a wild revision of history and a mistelling of history to say that, you know, rock and roll comes from blues and country. I think those were influences on rock and roll, but it's pretty clear the main through line was from pop music and swing. And, you know, that somebody like Louis Jordan, you know, is the acknowledged father of R&B and grandfather of rock and roll. And he comes straight out of his swing band with Chick Webb. You know, he's in a band with Ella Fitzgerald and Chick Webb in the 30s. And to me, it's just clear as day that jump blues comes from swing. Swing comes from New Orleans jazz. And New Orleans jazz comes from, you know, black folks getting a hold of marching band instruments and hearing the blues and also hearing lots of minstrelsy and vaudeville stuff and marching band songs and putting it all together into this new thing that they called jazz in the 20s that, you know, we now kind of call blues or classic blues and jazz. Anyway, so that's kind of how it metastasized out of control. And I have a habit of starting projects I can't finish. I mean, I knew there was no way I would ever pull off everything I was trying to do, but we pulled off a fair bit of it. And I'm pretty proud of what we've done.
You have an incredible library. Now, part of that library are these collections of episodes with people you've made into series. I think those are probably my favorite. Like, personally, I love the techno series with Ryan Harkness. I think that was just leagues beyond anything I've ever heard in any music podcast. Nobody ever really covers techno. So that was pretty cool to get not one, not two, but three big seasons of techno. What was your favorite, and what spurred you on to start these little segmented chunks?
Well, you know, since Ed gave me two seasons of A History of Rock and Roll, it was kind of a logical thing to look at other genres and try to tell those stories in series. And I think the techno one was probably my favorite, just because I learned so much. Mm-hmm. I knew nothing about DJ based music. I knew a little bit about disco, but I didn't understand it at all. I was trying to understand it as if it was rock records. I was trying to, you know, buy an OJ's album and listen to the album, and didn't realize that that's not how that music was heard, that that music came to life in discos when DJs played, you know, the singles and blended the songs and stretched out the dance beats and, you know, turned a 3-minute song into a 12-minute dance odyssey, and then segued seamlessly into the next song, expanded that one out. And, you know, once I read, you know, the books that we use for the sources of Techno Roll, you know, particularly Last Night a DJ Saved My Life, that really helped me understand it. And it was really exciting and fun to kind of skim through the surface of this genre that I had more familiarity with than I realized. I mean, you know, when I was in high school, I was at the big club in Dallas. It was one of the first places to play techno outside of Detroit and Chicago. And, you know, they were giving away free MDMA. So that was quite an experience. And then, and, you know, I'd been to some raves in the 90s and been, you know, knew a lot of people that were heavily into dance music and had heard them playing it. Although I couldn't get a handle on it. It wasn't written about in the magazines that I read, and I didn't understand how it was made or really how to appreciate it, other than, you know, if I was going out to go dancing. And the only reason I would ever go dancing was if I was looking for girls or drugs. And, you know, so I wasn't paying a lot of attention to the music. I certainly wasn't bugging the DJ to ask what records they were playing or how do you do this. And so learning all that stuff, and especially, you know, from Ryan's firsthand experience as a DJ, and he's just great fun to work with. And you know, I think Simon Reynolds' book that we did the second series on, you know, really taught me a lot about the evolution of the different post acid house styles in England and the road to jungle. But you know, it was just interesting. That was probably my favorite one. And the one that I'm sort of the most disappointed with was the Latin Roll series. I wish we could have gotten more of Ned Sublet's time, because his work is just so monumental. And I really think that Latin music is a big part of the iceberg that's under the surface of American musical history. And it's kind of written out of the history, but it's a huge, huge part. And it's really a direct pipeline to, you know, sub-Saharan Africa and the rhythmic mastery that the African traditions put together, which is just amazing. The things they were doing with beats in the Congo, right around the same time Bach was tempering the clavier in Europe, you know, that they were advancing the science of rhythm just as much as Bach was advancing the science of harmony around the same time, and probably well before Bach. And it's just, you know, that whole history is really fascinating. I wish I'd been able to tell it more and better. That's something I might come back and try again to finish.
There was another series that I liked a whole heck of a lot, and that was the gospel series. And I think you guys did a really good job. I loved the parts when they would talk about how, I believe it was Mahalia would like show a little tiny bit of ankle. I love that. You know, it was fantastic stuff.
There's actually plenty of documentation. And, you know, had I not been laid off early last year, you know, we had a pretty clear plan to carry it through kind of the end of the golden age of gospel. Yeah, but it was amazing. It was fun to learn about and understand and kind of put it in the context of the various Black denominations and the way that the Baptists were competing with the Pentecostals and, you know, were willing to take somebody like Thomas A. Dorsey, who is coming from a straight blues jazz background. I mean, he's the father of hokum, which is a subgenre of blues, and, you know, wrote some incredibly dirty songs before he came back to the Lord and, you know, stuck it out with church music the rest of his life. But, you know, it was just fascinating to learn about that and the way that some of the performers like Rosetta Tharpe were coming straight out of the Pentecostal tradition, and others, you know, like Mahalia Jackson were coming from a Baptist tradition, but informed by Pentecostalism. And really, you know, when we interviewed R.J. Smith about his brilliant musical history of Los Angeles in the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s on Central Avenue, his description of the first Pentecostal meetings in 1908. I mean, to me, that's where the rock and roll spirit really starts. And it's just fascinating to learn about that stuff and the way that energy exploded out at the same time as, you know, the Black middle class was trying to make their church music more palatable to white people, like they were sort of seeking approval and smoothing it off and taking it further and further away from the original spirituals in the fields and you know, kind of the secret African-American culture of the enslaved peoples, and the Pentecostal energy just explodes out in this other place, you know, and brought that spirit of revival back. And to me, without that infusion of passion and power that the Pentecostals brought, you wouldn't have Martin Luther King. I mean, you know, somebody like C.L. Franklin, Aretha Franklin's father, who's one of King's biggest allies and, you know, probably the most important Black preacher in Detroit in the 60s, that they drew so much from gospel music and also the dignity of their ancestors who had been trying to civilize or culturevi or whatever. You know, they were trying to make gospel music kind of highfalutin, or it wasn't even gospel, it was, you know, sacred songs. And that combination, I think, gave somebody like MLK so much of his power. And you know, the tight correlations between the civil rights movement and the birth of soul music. It's just an incredible story. And to me, you know, that's the real power of music. I mean, I don't think Thomas Dorsey and Mahalia Jackson had any idea what they were lighting the fuse on, but, you know, I'm glad they got to live to see some of the successes of the civil rights movement in the 60s. And I hope that I'm sure they knew that their music had played a big part in making that happen.
Do you have an episode that you feel stands head and shoulders above all the rest? Maybe this is the episode that you say, hey, come and check out my show and start here.
I think the interview I got to do with Mark Lewison about the Beatles, in particular, how the Beatles got signed to EMI, was the one I'm most proud of. I mean, he's probably the music researcher I admire the most. His work on the Beatles is just incredible. I kind of wonder if he's not waiting to see if Yoko Ono and Paul McCartney pass away sometime soon so he can write more about them. But that's just speculation. But I know that he's no longer, you know, officially blessed by the Beatles or doesn't have the access he used to. And so it's curious because he's such a scrupulous and honest chronicler. And, you know, other writers like Bob Spitz, who did a biography of the Beatles, you know, he said in his notes that he had heard a lot of stories about like their sex lives with fans and things like that, and that he made a deliberate choice not to get into that kind of stuff and, you know, destroyed his notes and everything. And Lewison is just such a stickler for the truth that I don't think he has he just would refuse to do that. And so I can imagine that, you know, the first book ended on January 31st or December 31st, 1962. And so the next installment is supposed to cover 63 to 66. And, you know, the Beatles were indulging in, you know, the things that came with fame and money of an unprecedented and really never matched again level of fame and in a period of real sexual openness and changing. So, you know, I just feel like Lewison might have some stories in there that Yoko and Paul McCartney don't necessarily want to get out. And also, you know, he's such a meticulous researcher, and he proved in the first book that, you know, George Martin didn't decide to sign the Beatles on his own, that he was forced to, in large part because he'd been having an affair with his secretary at EMI and they didn't approve of that kind of thing. And they, you know, held that over his head, and the publishing arm of EMI wanted to sign the Beatles and publish their music. And, you know, so it was very fun to get Lewison to tell that specific story, which is one of, like, I think two or three things that I thought were the biggest revelations that he proved conclusively just through doggedly going through so much paperwork at the record company and memos and interviews with surviving people. And, you know, and he'd been working on it since the 80s. So he'd interviewed a lot of people that had passed now. So anyway, yeah, that would be my favorite episode. But there's a lot I'm proud of. I had a lot of fun doing the series.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Mine is the Rick James episode, I think. I really enjoyed the stuff you did with Brooks Long, and the episode y'all did on the Rick James was pretty awesome. I love that one.
Well, yeah, I loved working with Brooks and learning from Brooks and getting to talk. You know, that when I discovered David Ritz and realized how many biographies he'd ghostwritten and how many books he'd written, you know, and then, you know, David Ritz is in his 80s and he's busy and has new books he wants to talk about. And you know, so finding Brooks Long, who was willing to dive into that body of work, and I'm really proud of our, you know, it's basically another series, the David Ritz Library. I mean, David Ritz's contribution to the historiography of R&B and soul music is pretty peerless. And, you know, I got to speak to David Ritz once, and that was fascinating, and getting insights into what the music had meant for him personally and how it had led him to convert to Christianity, you know, in the end. You know, it was a true spiritual journey led by the music. But yeah, he helped so many people tell their stories, and, you know, I'm really proud of what we got down, and hopefully, you know, would love to come back and make some more podcasts with Brooks, because there's still more David Ritz books we haven't covered. But yeah, the Rick James story was really fascinating, and I enjoyed learning about him a lot. And talking about him.
I don't think people knew how old he was when he became famous, as opposed to how far back he got started. I had no idea.
Yeah, I didn't know any of that either, and it explains so much. You know, I'd always kind of looked at Rick James as kind of
he just burst on the scene, it seemed like, when Super Freak came out, but he'd been around for like 20 years before that.
Yeah, and he'd been big on the R&B charts for five or 6 years before Super Freak came out. Yeah, and it just explains so much. I mean, I didn't understand when I was younger, why he had faded so hard in the 80s. I just assumed that he had really just gone off the deep end with drugs. But now that I understand that, you know, I mean, very few artists continue to do pioneering work into their 30s and 40s, especially after they get rich and famous. And the fact that he had already been through so many identities, you know, doing folk rock. I mean, being in a band with Neil Young, that was not
that
something.
Right there was what got me. I mean, so yeah. Many twists and turns in his career that I never knew anything about.
Yeah. And you know, his autobiography is just full of these adventures and misadventures and you know, lots of trouble with the law from the day he was born, pretty much. And yeah, it was fascinating to learn about that. And that, you know, he'd been through a folk rock phase and an R&B phase and a fusion rock phase, jazz fusion rock phase. And, you know, finally found the right mix in the late 70s. And just, yeah, for a few years there, he was the king of funk, but then Prince came along and pushed him to the side.
What's your take on the direction of music journalism? Because right now we're seeing journalism take some weird turns in general with all media, whether it be news media or pop culture or music. I saw last week, I can't remember the name of the outlet, but it's pretty popular.
Pitchfork.
What was Pitchfork? That's right.
Yeah.
Closed yeah. down. I mean, you talked about Ed, you know, not being able to sort of keep a foothold. You yourself, me, you know, Bloody Elbow, we all have experienced this. So what's your take on the direction of music journalism, especially with AI and Google and social media pretty much cannibalizing everything?
I mean, I wish I knew, because then I might be able to navigate it better. But it's multiple cycles that are kind of coming to ends at the same time. I think that all of Western culture, to a certain extent, is exhausted. I think, you know, European culture lost global dominance in World War One. I mean, you can just see it in the music. Before World War One started, people in America and all over the world looked to Europe for their kind of cultural points. You know, what are they doing in Europe? Who's the hot composer? What kind of operas are they? You know, what's the big new opera in Italy? You know, what's the big symphony coming out of Germany? You know, and World War One happens, and by the end of World War One, suddenly it's jazz and blues and African Americans are just taking over the world, you know, and America has suddenly the action's happening in America, and Europe gets to stand back and watch. And I think that has definitely come to an end. I think what we're seeing, you know, geopolitically is this inexorable decline of the power of the West and the United States. And we're seeing Hollywood run itself into the ground. I mean, the neoliberal business practices and this ethos of strip mining everything for all the wealth that you can get out of something, you know, and then funnel that up to the handful of people at the very, very top. That's just not a good way to run a culture. And people who excel at grabbing power and putting themselves in places where they have a monopoly control on a market and just extract a rent, those people are not going to be good at, say, running a movie studio or a record label. I didn't get to do episodes on, you know, what happened to the record industry in the 90s and 2000s and why the internet disrupted it so much and how fat and sassy they had gotten in the 90s and corrupt. But there's such a difference between the music executives in the 90s and 2000s and the music executives that made the great music. I mean, the cultural explosions happened in America when a lot of small entrepreneurs had a shot, when somebody like Sam Phillips with no capital, no connections could revolutionize the music world, you know, by discovering Elvis Presley and the business forces aligned against that and made it harder and harder to happen. I mean, in the 60s, you know, bands like the Kingsmen could record a record in the local studio in Seattle, print it up, get it played on the radio, and it could become a national hit. And that didn't happen anymore by the 70s. And, you know, then in the 90s, they passed the Communications Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the communication, the 96 Communications Bill, and just allow the monopolization of radio stations across the country and let, you know, fewer and fewer record companies have more and more power. And then, you know, one story that I would love to have told, but I couldn't get anybody to come on the show and talk about it, was the massive fires at Universal Music Studio that the New York Times reported on. And there were a number of lawsuits by artists against Universal, and the courts ruled against the artists in every case. And you know, the people who put that story out got legal advice discouraging them from talking about it publicly. And, you know, it's a situation where a warehouse on the Universal Studios lot burned up and may have taken 500,000 priceless original recordings and destroyed them. And this is, you know, this is the Louvre of American music. This was, you know, the work of Bing Crosby and Chuck Berry and the Chess record label and, you know, the Decca record label and, you know, Billie Holiday and all the way up to Geffen and, you know, in the 90s and Nirvana and Soundgarden and Hole. I mean, just all this classic American music just poof, burned up and destroyed, lost. There was tons of unreleased stuff that had historical value. And to me, you know, our copyright laws got so distorted in the 60s so that a couple of big companies could hold on to assets like Mickey Mouse or Superman as long as possible. But meanwhile, thousands of books were lost because they should have gone into the public domain where they could have been archived and, you know, the scholars and people who care about that stuff could go through and say, oh, this book needs more attention. This book, you know, throw these away, but let's keep these. That didn't get to happen to American creative productions from 1923 on. I mean, they just kept pushing the date back and back. And the net outcome of these monopolies was that one company owned so many master tapes and had no interest in taking proper care of them. And when that story came out, one of the other major labels basically fired all their music archivists because they were afraid they would talk about how poorly, you know, how little resources they were given to storing this stuff. And it's as somebody cares about history and American music, it's just devastating to me. I mean, it's as if somebody set fire to the, you know, National Gallery and lost all those paintings. I mean, that stuff we don't get back. You know, there's not any more Bing Crosby's. There's not another Billie Holiday. We don't get another Chuck Berry or Buddy Holly. And those master tapes had sound quality that is still better than the reproduction. I mean, you know, as if you believe in progress, if this technology gets better, there was more data on those master tapes than has ever been heard or, you know, and it's just unfathomable to me that was lost. And I feel like that's what's killed music journalism. It's what has killed the record industry, is just the whole game is for big players to put themselves in control of a market and then quote unquote extract value, as one of my least favorite Hollywood executives says. You know, they just strip mine things, and sometimes they take a perfectly good business, like what they did to Toys R Us, where they take a perfectly good business that could be profitable with a legacy and a history and all these stakeholders. But the only stakeholders that officially matter are shareholders. So employees don't care, don't count. Customers don't count. You know, people had their whole lives and careers wrapped up in Toys R Us, and they just burned it up so people like Mitt Romney can extract cash from it for a few years.
It's tragic.
Yeah, it's tragic. And it's going to come a cropper. I mean, these idiots that run our society are running the thing into the ground. And these wars we're seeing now, I think, are a function of this neoliberal cabal that's been in control of the United States since Reagan, refusing to let go of power, refusing to adapt to change. And I'm afraid that other powers are going to force us to change. And, you know, we're heading into times when there's going to be a lot worse things to worry about than music history, I'm afraid.
What's your take on the virtual tour experience? Because this has been something that's really blown up in the last 2 years. And it's been big around two particular stars, Beyonce and Taylor Swift. Do you think we're going to see more of this, or are they special and only they probably have the powers to do that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that the music industry can create another Beyonce or Taylor Swift at this point in time. You know, I mean, Beyonce's been around since the late 90s, and there was a much bigger megaphone for mainstream media at that point than there is now. I mean, now it's this Tower of Babel, and I don't know if you know, I don't know if somebody like Olivia Rodrigo is ever going to be as big as Taylor Swift or Beyonce. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that you can make another one. So I really don't know. And those ticket prices are just out of my reach. So I haven't, you know, my daughter would like to go to Olivia Rodrigo, and I'm just not paying $600 for two tickets to a show like that. It's ridiculous.
You but know? Now they have the virtual tour where you can go to, you can pay like a certain amount and go
and see it
in a theater.
Online. Well, I mean,
you can see it also online, or you can like a couple of them. Like I know Taylor Swift had theaters that were running the show. So, I mean, I just think that's, wow. You know, in the last two, and we've just seen that in the last 2 years, that's pretty enormous.
Yeah. I mean, that does kind of democratize it and bring it to more people. I don't know. I haven't seen the virtual show, so I don't know.
Me either. I just noticed that it got big recently because of Taylor Swift's tour, her Eras tour just wrapped.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that Taylor Swift is so big now because she's really kind of at the end-ish part of her career. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's already re-recorded all of her, you know, early body of work, which I'm always skeptical of stuff like that. Then you're never going to catch the magic again. And, you know, so I don't think that it's not like she's a new star and has another 20 years in her. I think maybe she's got another 10, 15 years before she turns into Madonna or whatever. But I don't know. I don't know. It's future's not mine to see. And it's the kids that are growing up on this music that are going to decide, you know, what the verdict is. But I assume they'll do more and more of that stuff. But you know, with AI, I really think we could be descending into a Tower of Babel kind of situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so easy to make, you know, Taylor Swift is currently suing a bunch of people for putting out sexually explicit AI creations that use her image and likeness, you know, in ways that she finds deeply offensive. And I would too, you know, and so it's just really going to be a hall of mirrors in the future, trying to separate, you know, what did humans actually create here? And is what we really need mountains more content? You know, I mean, there's already too many people trying to create content, and there's very few gatekeepers or very few people saying this is the stuff, you know, that needs to be brought to a bigger audience, or this is the stuff that matters or is important. And you know, gatekeepers aren't perfect, and it was exciting to kind of push them aside, but they've come back in other ways. I mean, after the Trump election, the way legacy media used that and the government used that to arm twist the big tech monopolies, such that, you know, independent media got pushed aside and downgraded. And you know, after the cable news networks and the New York Times led us into the Iraq war, suddenly disinformation is a big problem. And the cure for it is the New York Times and CNN. Like, give me a break, you know? And that was really disheartening and kind of when I gave up hope that the internet would be a positive change. And now it's clearly this AI thing is extremely icky and I don't like where it's headed at all. Although I do look forward to young, poor musicians somewhere getting a hold of AI tools and making some really crazy, sick music. I mean, like the episodes we did with Kit McIntosh, where he kind of caught us up with some of the things that the young creators in Jamaica and Brooklyn and London are doing with auto-tune and the way they're using it just to meld the human voice with machines. And that, you know, I was glad to see that there's still innovation happening. And I think innovation will continue. What I worry about is there's no coherent cultural mass narrative to share and to bring people together. And I feel like we're, at least in America, we're about to tear ourselves apart.
Indeed. Final question. Do you feel you accomplished your goal with Let It Roll?
Oh, God, no. I mean, there's so much. I want to finish the Latin Roll series. I think that's really important. I want to learn more about opera. I want to learn more about the beginnings of the music business. You know, when did they first sell sheet music? When did they start selling tickets to the public for concerts? You know, when did opera become kind of a mass medium? How did music hall evolve in England and you know, the other countries? I've got a book on the polka revolution of 1848.
I'm sorry. that's, you know, that's some deep diving right there.
Yeah. And, you know, but figuring out how these things all connect, it's polka is still a big part of the story. I mean, in the way it pops back up in Conjunto and Norteño and, you know, Texas Latino music, it's just awesome to me. I mean, you know, the Germans walk away from the accordions and the two-step beat, the 2-4 time, and these Mexican kids are like, hey, what's this? You know, and just grab it and run. I mean, that to me is the beauty of music, is just the cross-pollination and the cultural appropriation. I mean, I just think that's bullshit. I think it's every human being's inheritance, you know, and anybody that can contribute to it should. I mean, obviously I see the downside of and the inequities, you know, and it's not fair that black artists before Michael Jackson couldn't be the big superstar, that, you know, somebody like B.B. King would never have a chance to be Elvis or the Beatles, you know, and you know, that wasn't fair and that wasn't right. But at the same time, you know, I feel like Elvis and Beatles gave back a lot and influenced a lot of black artists, you know, and that it's appropriation everywhere. I'm reading a book about barbershop quartets right now. And the guy set out to start out and prove that, you know, that barbershop quartets were an African-American tradition and that were swiped by white people. And he came out of his research going, wow, no, this was a African-American and Anglo-American tradition. And they were cross-pollinating the whole time, ripping each other off right and left. And, you know, everything's much more complicated than these simple stories. And I like picking apart the nuance, you know. So yeah, I never got to talk about that. I really would like to have had a chance to talk about minstrelsy, but that's a topic, you know, nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to be on the record talking about blackface, and yet that's where American music comes from, all of it, you know, that was the first time African American music got brought to a world audience, even though it was in a twisted, distorted, mockery way. So many black songwriters and performers had careers in minstrelsy in the second half of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. I mean, we wouldn't have Burt Williams if we didn't have minstrelsy, and you know, he's the first great black Broadway star, and records still pack some power. And then, you know, the idea that Al Jolson is remembered and hated as a mega racist when he wasn't racist at all. He was just a Jewish immigrant trying to adapt to American traditions, and blackface minstrelsy was like the most all-American thing you could find. And also he got a lot of power from wearing that mask, and black performers did that too, like Pigmeat Markham. You know, that's one story I did get to tell with R.J. Smith. I mean, poor Pigmeat Markham, you know, was this comedian who came up black guy wearing blackface, and he was sad to his dying day that he was pressured into no longer performing in blackface. He felt like he was better, that he could play to the back of the room and make, you know, that there was some artistry to that. And I mean, it's not my place to say whether or not, you know, he should have been continuing to perform in blackface, but then finding out that his cadences from records he made in the 60s directly influenced DJ Hollywood, who directly influences Melly Mel, who directly influences everybody in hip hop. I mean, that's the kind of shit I love digging up, and these connections. And, you know, so it would have been cool to get to talk about that. I mean, you know, I am frustrated that I didn't start doing this earlier when people like Nick Toshes were alive and I could have talked to him, but I'm sure I would have said all kinds of horrible crap in the 90s that would have gotten me canceled in the 2000s. So, you know, it is what it is. I feel like we took a good stab at it, and I feel like I've got the outline out there if other people want to pick up the torch and run with it. I mean, still need a history of Broadway music, history of minstrelsy, history of opera, history of symphonic music. As I think it all connects, you know, much more to do on the history of jazz. I'm still really fascinated. I feel like I did some good work around that 1940s point where jazz goes from being the dance music, the pop music, and the art music to suddenly just the art music. That it's so fascinating to me that Louis Jordan and Charlie Parker just take it in two different directions. And Charlie Parker's got all this cultural cachet, and Louis Jordan's basically forgotten because he was funny and he sang cool, simple songs, you know. And I swear, you put on Charlie Parker at a party and you put on Louis Jordan, I know which party's going to be more fun. You know? I loved Charlie Parker, not to take anything away from him. And I think what he did was, you know, what he and Dizzy Gillespie did was very important for black middle-class artists to say, hey, we're artists. This is serious shit. We're doing incredible things musically. We're the most innovative musicians on the planet, which they were. And you know, make this demand for dignity and also chase the white boys off the stage. Like, if you can't keep up, Cracker, you can't keep up. And the white boys who could keep up, they got invited back. You know, I mean, you know, learning those stories and learning about the way, you know, Dizzy's alliance with the Latin music and how, you know, I really think that if there hadn't been the musician's strike and we had gotten to hear bebop being born on record, and not had this 4-year blackout, that shit might have been pop music. You know, I mean, if Dizzy and you know, had been able to combine the Cuban dance styles with this innovative new solo style, you know, they might have done it in ways that were more palatable to a pop audience. And maybe that wouldn't be great, you know, but maybe the way things happen is just the way they had to happen. But, you know, I love thinking about that shit. You know, why did bebop not catch on? Because they originally thought it would. It was the big new music in New York. They went to LA. Everybody in LA was excited to hear them. They sell out big clubs. And by the end of the week, nobody's coming back. And it was also, a lot of it was because Ed kind of wrote jazz out of the history of rock and roll, which, you know, I totally just drives me crazy. And I think is ahistorical, but it's something that the baby boomers did. They really tried to write out the pop history of their parents' generation and disconnect it, you know, tried to make rock and roll kind of a year zero event. And anytime you have somebody declaring a year zero where nothing in the past mattered and this is where history starts, you always got to be suspicious. And that's when you really want to look into the history.
You've got an incredible library, that's for sure. I mean, hundreds of episodes, and they're all informative. So for this last bit, we have not played any songs. I'm sure people have noticed that, because for years we always have 4 song snippets, but not today. This is a different episode for sure. So you have selected one song to take us out. Tell us the song and take us out, Nate.
This is a song my kids hate that I'm obsessed with. This is this guy, John McCormick, who is an Irish opera singer. And he also sold a lot of records singing traditional Irish songs. And this song, Molly Brannigan, for whatever reason, just hooked me, and I've listened to it thousands of times. I'll put it on loop for hours and days straight. And so this is kind of my favorite song, John McCormick's Molly Brannigan.
Mom, dear, did you never hear a pretty Molly Brannigan? And troth, and she's left me, and I'll never be a man again. Not a spot on me hide will the summer sun e'er tan again, since Molly's gone and left me here alone for to die. The place where me heart was, you daisy roll a turnip in, 'tis as large as all Dublin, and from Dublin to the Divil's Glen. If she wished to take another, sure she might have left mine back again, and not have gone and left.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.